Mainstream Mental Health Radio
with Dr. John Huber.
What do you think you are, crazy or something? Well, you're not.
We're on a mission from God.
News, issues revolving around mental health.
Dr. John Huber, a mental health professional for over 20 years, the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, a clinical forensic psychologist, and a psychology professor at Texas State University. Breaking the silence of mental health, one day at a time, discussing the human condition, providing a sounding board for mental health issues, and making mental health mainstream.
You got a gift, my friend.
Now it's time for Mainstream Mental Health Radio.
Let the healing begin.
With Dr. John Huber.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Mainstream Mental Health Radio Show. I'm your host, Dr. John Huber. Thanks very much for listening, as we really do appreciate it. We have another fantastic show planned today. Remember to check out our website at mainstreammentalhealth.org and let your friends and family know about the show. You can listen to us on our podcast at iTunes at blogtalkradio.com, Mainstream Mental Health. And we're going to look at some news stories this week. And then after that, we have a couple of really interesting guests that I'm excited to have here this week. And now let's talk about our news. Playing video games might be an effective way to help people with depression. I have kids. I have college students who talk to me about their video games. My kids talk about their video games. When my kids aren't happy, they go and play video games. And, man, you want to talk about picking their spirits up. And this research is coming out of the University of California, Davies. And it's kind of interesting that they're going beyond just playing the game. They're talking about how video games, if they're designed right, might actually help people deal with true depression, mild depression. And there's some additional stories I've read over the past 6 to 8 months about other people coming in with their research on video games to treat depression. I think if we can figure out how to do this effectively, I think this is a great modality and a great way to get people help without necessarily having to go and see a therapist or go get on antidepressant medications and things like that. So, I mean, we've already got something we're using. Why not see if we can make it work and treat this issue? Basically, they found that they set up a series of 6 3-minute games, and people found that in a majority of cases, playing these games specifically designed to help people feel they have some control over their depression, and they found that actually caused them to feel like they were more in control of their depression and less a victim of their depression. I think it's an amazing thing that should be happening anyhow in therapy, is that they start learning to get control over their depression. Mental health therapists are also seeing an uptick in patients struggling with post-election anxiety. And maybe we should get them hooked up with the video games. But on the East Coast in Seattle, they have seen that there has been a significant increase in people coming in, new clients coming in, reporting difficulties. In fact, as many as 80% of the new clients were coming in seeking help for post-election distress. In urban areas such as Seattle, these stress levels seem to be higher than in rural or suburban areas, with about 62% of city dwellers saying the election and its outcome were significant sources of stress. Survey also found that the percentage of people feeling stressed and their personal safety was the highest since the question was first asked in 2008. And again, reading the research from the Seattle Times, they're focused primarily in the Northwest. I don't know if this is a good representation of our whole nation, but I do know that there is a significant level of stress related to the election going on here. And these stress symptoms tended to be headaches, anxiety, and oftentimes depression. And these have popped up in this population 70 to 80% over the past 5 month period that they looked at this. I know that I get a lot of patients dealing with stress. Is it an increase over previous populations that came in before the election dealing with election stress. I've had one or two people come in specifically for stress related to the election. And one of the things we found out that we could do with them is stop focusing on the news, especially right before they go to bed. Stay away from news media. Don't read news on their phones or iPads at night before they go to bed. And almost immediately they started sleeping better and feeling better. So, you know, it's just a behavioral technique that they have to learn. Hey, I can't go and look at that material right when you go into your slumber state, because that can be problematic, definitely. All right. Remember, you're listening here to Mainstream Mental Health Radio Show. Again, my name is Dr. John Huber. Check us out at mainstreammentalhealth.org. Last week, we talked about mothers dealing with postpartum depression using marijuana here, actually in Austin, Texas. And now we're finding out that there may be a chemical inside marijuana, according to LifeScience.com, that specifically helps fight anxiety. The chemical is a cannabinoidal, and it helps people treat and deal with their anxiety. Now, Texas legislature has passed that the cannabinoid oils are out there are legal to use for certain treatment or certain disorders here in Texas. So it'll be interesting to know if anybody here is actually going in and starting to do research on the cannabinoids in the oil and see if it helps with their anxiety, especially if we're looking at post-traumatic stress disorder. I think we get affected by post-traumatic stress disorder more than we think, and it's not just our soldiers coming back from war, but it's also victims of any kind of trauma, including sexual trauma. And even recently with sexual trauma, we're finding out that it's happening a lot more frequently than we want to talk about or than actually shows up in the media. But if this is a legitimate modality that we can use as cannabinoids for to try and treat anxiety, this could be a big benefit to our soldiers, our veterans returning back from war, and it may be able to also help us right here at home dealing with traumas throughout our everyday civilian life. If we talk about rape trauma, we need to realize that in general we have two different phases. One phase is the acute phase. It typically happens immediately following the assault. And then you jump into the reorganization phase. And this may include a period of time when it's kind of known as the underground stage, in which the victim tries to pretend like nothing happened. They try to convince themselves that the trauma did not occur. And they may try and block thoughts of the assault from their mind altogether. Everyone's different when they respond to sexual trauma. Here's just a few ideas that some of you who may know someone who's experienced or experiencing sexual trauma to think about. First of all, from the beginning, the most significant thing to realize is that it's not the fault of the victim, that the attacker is the only one who is to blame. You also have to realize that the negative feelings that you have are a result of the sexual trauma. You know, the self-deprecation that a lot of people have after experiencing that, it's not reality. It is your body's reaction, your brain's reaction to that trauma. So you want to try and get reconnected with your body, with your whole internal support system, as well as your own support network. So stay around friends. Try not to isolate yourself. I say exercise works wonders for your body. Rhythmic exercises, there's reports that show that may be most helpful when dealing with this type of trauma. If one exercise isn't working, don't give up. There's a lot of other ones out there. Just realize that you can't unlive sexual trauma, but you can realize that it's not who you are. Work through the pain and learn how to live your life on your terms. You can still have an amazing life. And one more reminder, you're listening to Mainstream Mental Health Radio Show. I'm Dr. John Huber. We have two amazing guests today. Kiara James is an executive at an organization called Force, Upsetting Rape Culture. She has been involved with projects such as affirmative consent legislation for Maryland's higher education system, Force's video project detailing consent from the perspective of everyday intimate interactions, as well as those close workings with the Monument Quilt Project. Then we have Angela Escoville. She's Assistant Dean of Students at Stanford University's Graduate Life Office. She is also a co-founder and chief executive officer of the As One Project, a national 501c3 organization that supports friends and family and survivors of sexual assault. In July of 2012, Angela was asked to speak alongside Senators Boxer, Murray, and Blumenthal at a United States Senate press conference in support of the reauthorization of the Bipartisan Violence Against Women Act. Ms. Escoville, Mrs. James, welcome to our show.
Hello, good evening. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for being here, both of you. So I don't know who wants to start first, but I know this is something that's come up recently, and I teach at a university here in Texas, and I hear from our graduates and some of the research actually that's taken place at University of Texas when they went to the graduates and they asked them anonymously, and a significant number of female students after they graduate are reporting that they had been sexually assaulted, and less than 6% of those said they ever told anybody, let alone reporting it to the university. Do you think that this recent increase in some of these sexual assaults is a result of maybe students feeling more comfortable and coming forward, or what do you think is going on over the past 5 years?
Sure, you're welcome to go first if you'd like.
Okay, great. Just from my perspective, kind of like boots on the groundwork that I've been doing with FORCE and on campuses as a student at Morgan State, you know, it's a topic that's come up more now. You know, we had Brock Turner, we had Nate Parker, you know, we have all of these things going on in the media most recently, and so it's become more of a conversation. That coupled with, you know, larger efforts to eradicate certain issues of slut shaming, things that lead to rape culture, understanding how, like, my clothing or my intoxication levels does not make it so that I ask for these things to happen. So that's a big part of why I believe that we're having more people coming forward.
I would definitely agree and echo that. I think that the surge in reporting is actually a good thing. I don't think that it reflects necessarily a surge in actual number of assaults happening, but just the fact that more people are aware of the issue itself and also aware of the resources that are available to survivors in the aftermath of an assault. So I do think that the increased visibility of this issue is something that is shocking and concerning to many, but it is a part of helping people realize that they're not alone and that they're not going through these experiences or they don't have to go through these experiences in isolation.
I think you both are correct. I agree just from my experience in the classroom at the university and in talking with my graduates afterwards, and as I get to know them and talk with them after college life, I think that, Kiara, you're exactly right. You know, the awareness that it's not me causing this, you know, that somebody else did that. It doesn't matter what I wore, how I acted, or what, you know, what I drank, or if I chose not to drink at all, that this is definitely not their fault. And so I think you're right. They are more willing to come forward. And Angela, I think you're right in that the numbers probably haven't increased. It's that social awareness and then them coming forward that's increased. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, we've also had a new kind of sexualization with the internet. I mean, you know, smartphones are about 10 years old and instant pornography and some of the popularity of, you know, like gonzo porn depicts sexual violence against men and women. I think that has created an atmosphere that is telling people that maybe that's the way, you know, sexuality and sex is supposed to be. Any thoughts?
Sure. I mean, I I used to teach human sexuality at George Washington University, and we would talk about things like pornography and its influence in our culture. You know, I think that it does portray a skewed version of sexuality and certainly a skewed version of consent. And I think that, you know, you don't really see porn actors negotiating consent in the way that might be necessary in real life situations. And so I think it's one of those things where, you know, certainly it can, you know, that type of pornography that portrays violence against women can perpetuate and help contribute to the normalization of that. But I think that pornography in general, you know, it's not to demonize it as a whole, but I think it's for young adults who are very impressionable, give them a skewed perception of what sexual encounters are supposed to look like and feel like and how they're supposed to communicate in those types of environments.
Kiara,
I definitely agree.
Do you think that? Yes, that's where I was going. and then also I was going to ask Kiara, you know, since you're, you know, boots on the ground, so to speak, have you seen, you know, the introduction of like 50 Shades of Grey and that whole, you know, here's this 30-page consent form that we have to go through line by line. You know, do you think that's kind of changed college students' perception of consent?
Yes and yes. So going back to your original question, you know, dealing with pornography, I just want to say briefly, I strongly feel like there's a bigger issue of education or around sex and around consent, because a lot of young people who I've interacted with just on campus and with other campuses they just don't seem to understand exactly what consent is and how consent happens and how just because a person was drunk does not negate or, you know, or even add consent. Specifically speaking,
right.
It's a bigger issue of education and of, I guess, honestly, you know, parenting at schools, not being afraid to have that conversation is honestly a bigger part of how we get, because, you know, we're going to learn regardless. Curious minds are going to figure out what they want to learn about. And so what you want to do is give them the truth. And what you want to do is really introduce it in ways that is accurate and that is healthy. So that's just that question. Going back to the 50 Shades of Grey, kind of these types of things, you know, when 50 Shades came out, it was a really, really big conversation among myself and some of my peers because, you know, half of us were, like, really excited to see this movie and, oh, my gosh, this guy was so hot or whatever, you know, however young people approach the situation. And then there's another group that was like, you do realize that if he was, you know, like, more so unattractive or was not as financially stable as he was, this would be a Criminal Minds episode. So it's really kind of, you know, gross to see how concepts of appearance and attractiveness, concepts of, you know, money or other types of monetary value, you know, social value that we understand, and how that plays such a huge role also. Because, you know, like I said, if he was not rich and if he was not some type of attractive, this would be completely different. You know, it's like you think about other places where this could happen every day. You know, if you think about someone at work who gets, you know, kind of like overpowered or whatever by their boss or by a manager or some sort like that, and how it leads to this issue. And so the fact that, you know, Hollywood, the mainstream media, is making this such a regular thing, they're making it, you know, like not a big deal, as if this is not an issue at all. It's just like, oh, yeah, this is great. You know, give me $100. We can do whatever you want to do. Like, that was my thought on how 50 Shades of Grey just made it even worse and made my job harder.
You're talking about, like, he gives her a job, then he gives her a car, and then he wants to have all these bizarre sex acts with her.
Yeah.
As far as, like, a form of prostitution? Or I was looking at the whole consent of spelling out exactly where the limits are. And how that plays. And, you know, if you have that consent spelled out, you have everything written down. You know, I don't even know if SVU or anybody else would be interested in it unless, you know, of course, somebody violated the contract and harmed somebody.
And,
I mean, you know, playing the devil's advocate.
Oh, yeah, I hear you. See, And that was the work that I had did last year on affirmative consent legislation in Maryland, just talking about how you have to have consent for every act, with every partner, every time that occurs. So, for example, you know, going back to this 50 Shades of Grey kind of scenario. So, yes, maybe this time I would rather be, you know, bonded or something like that. You know, like I would rather be tied up or blindfolded. Just because I say that today doesn't necessarily inherently mean that I'm going to want the same type of sexual encounter next week. And so then that just goes back along with, you know, and additionally, you know, the education piece of understanding what it means to have this type of sex for you and with your partners, you know, because there's a lot of colloquial language that happens, and we believe that, you know, there's, like, common understandings. That's not necessarily true because, you know, one type of term for a sexual act might mean this in this community, whereas in another community it'd be a whole completely different thing. And that just goes along with, like, you know, colloquial language and how we understand each other in our own individual social environments.
Yeah, what are your thoughts? Yeah, I think that, you know, with the written contract idea, one thing that's important to note, too, is that consent can be withdrawn at any time. So while it could be helpful to have some sort of written or verbal, you know, negotiation on the front end, that doesn't take away a person's right to withdraw consent at any time and say, actually, I changed my mind. I'm not okay with that anymore. And that is, you know, I think Dave Chappelle even did a skit called The Love Contract one time where he's kind of like making fun of this idea that now, you know, everything has to be in writing and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's missing the point a little bit because I think what the point of consent is that it should be an active process. It's not a one-time thing. And so I think if we look at consent as a verb rather than a noun, that's something that helps kind of broaden the concept of what consent is and should look like. That way it's not like, well, consent is a contract. Well, that's not true. Consent is that process that you're going through continually throughout a sexual encounter with somebody that is, you know, helping all parties involved be comfortable and safe with what's happening. Yeah.
So Angela, then when should, you know, if a student comes to me and starts telling me about being, having a level of discomfort, whether, you know, questioning he or she, whether they actually consented, when should I tell or what should I tell my students to use as a guide before they go and report to the police?
Well, I think that reporting is one of many options that a student has. And so I think in the aftermath of...
I think we lost Angela, Kiara.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Honestly, the guide that we tend to go with the work that I'm doing when I speak with survivors or people who have had, I guess, instances of not being sure. Honestly, it's just the basic question of, did you want this to happen, yes or no? Because there's times and situations where, one, you can't say no because, you know, you're incapacitated or you're just so overly intoxicated that you don't necessarily know what's happening to you, or you aren't able to respond, and that's a solution.
That's definitely you need to report that. I mean that, you know.
Yes, definitely. Yes. Definitely. That's its own separate case and scenario.
Right.
Which honestly, it definitely happens. You know, there's statistics that talk about how often and all these things, but more importantly, when you have issues of acquaintance rape, you know, like or rape within a relationship. You know, so say you're dating a person and you've been dating this person, you've been, you know, having casual sex with this person throughout your relationship, and for whatever reason they seem to have, you know, talked you into something that you did not want to do. But you didn't know how to say no, or you were afraid to say no. You know, dealing with the Monument Quote Project and looking at stories from survivors, it's so alarming to see how many times survivors were afraid to say no or didn't know how to say no. And additionally speaking, you know, like when you look at someone in a trauma type of situation and you think about responses to trauma, a lot of people freeze. And
I think you're right.
Definitely a traumatic. And so, yeah,
definitely.
I feel like, you know, people tend to freeze, and sexual assault is definitely a traumatic situation. And so if your body just stops, just because you didn't say no doesn't mean that you wanted it to happen.
And I agree with that. So maybe we get back to Angela now and let her finish up where she got cut off.
Sure. Now. Sorry about that.
Life is what happens
yeah.
while you're making plans.
Yeah. I mean, I think just to wrap up what I was saying, you know, I think it's most important to give the person who has been through something as much power and control as possible. And so one way that they can regain a sense of empowerment in the aftermath of an assault is to feel like they have options and that they have control over if, when, and how they exercise those options.
And I know you started to go into that, and you know, once the police are notified, it's kind of taken out of their hands, so to speak, as far as those options. What other options, you know, because, again, you kind of got cut off right at that point, do we have or should our students have in that kind of a situation as far as reporting?
Sure. Well, one of those options is to get, you know, mental health resources, whether that's through a campus counseling center or at Stanford, we have a confidential support team that provides free counseling to people who've been impacted by sexual violence. So it could just be self-care options. It could be options that are more logistical or administrative. So if the alleged perpetrator was another student, do they need to switch their class schedule? Do they need a change in housing? Do they need, you know, a leave of absence from the university? And then, you know, of course, reporting to the university is always another option as well. And so that, you know, can vary in terms of what that looks like from institution to institution. But I think taking care of their kind of Maslow's hierarchy of needs first is often the
Correct.
Most important. You know, sometimes in the aftermath of an assault, what somebody really needs is a meal or a nap or, you know, something as simple as that, all the way up to, you know, considering their reporting options.
Exactly. Well, as we're running out of time here, so before we let everybody go, I'd like to have each of you, and maybe start with Kiara. How can my listeners get a hold of you if they have any questions or anything at this point?
Yeah, so I am affiliated with FORCE, Upsetting Rape Culture. And I'm always available by email. It is kmjames708@yahoo.com. Additionally speaking, you can go on the FORCE Upsetting Rape Culture website and look us up. It is upsettingrape.com. And that's just, you know, the basic way. And then there is a way to find me via the website. You just have to click on a couple of different separate links. But that's the best way to find
Great.
Me.
Excellent. Okay, Angela, and you, if our students or listeners want to find out more about you and what they should do.
Sure. Our organization's website is asoneproject.org, all spelled out. And my email address is Angela, A-N-G-E-L-A, @asoneproject.org. And I'd be happy to answer any questions or just continue the conversation with anybody who's interested.
Awesome. Well, I thank you both. I think we put a lot of information out there on the table. And, of course, you know, it left lots of other questions that on account of time restraints, we really can't go. But thank you for giving our listeners a way to get a hold of you and find out more about what you guys are doing. And I really appreciate you guys being on the air. Thank you.
Thank
of
you.
Course. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. All right, everyone, that concludes today's edition of Mainstream Mental Health Radio. Special thanks to our great guest, Kiara James and Angela Escoville. And to learn more about our show, please visit us at mainstreammentalhealth.org. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you here again next week. And remember, life is what happens while you're making plans, so buckle up.
Thanks for listening to Mainstream Mental Health Radio with your host, Dr. John Huber. Check us out on social media, Google+, Mainstream Mental Health, Instagram @MainstreamMentalHealth, Twitter @MainstreamMENTL, and search for Mainstream Mental Health on Facebook. Please tune in every week to Mainstream Mental Health Radio with your host, Dr. John Huber.
Because of something I would do.